So good morning again. Yes, thank you. As this is the first Sunday, we spent a little time giving a little more background, talking a little bit more about Buddha and Buddhism and how it relates to the various things that we do at Dawn Mountain, which include offering what we call life skills, the skills of attention, kindness, patience. These are things that are helpful in life. Buddhism has a lot to say about them, and we draw on those resources. And then also we do practice, we sit, we cultivate attention and kindness and qualities like patience. And that's centrally what we do on the 11 o'clock guided meditations. And we wanted to offer you more background on why and how and some of the history and some of the thought behind what we are doing. So for the last two first Sundays, we talked a little bit about the life of the Buddha. And I want to pick up a thread and talk about the life of the Buddha, which for Buddhists since the beginning of Buddhism, which arose, of course, after the life of the Buddha, the Buddha's life, which is told in many versions, some in which he's kind of an ordinary, although really excellent person, some of which he's really kind of a magnificent life force, a kind of embodiment of all the qualities that we seek and really a world-transcending being. And the stories of the Buddha have always been used as teachings, as ways to help us understand what it is that we are doing. It is said that when the Buddha walked forth from the side of his mother without giving her any pain, as I think we mentioned last time, he announced why he was here. He said, "I'm here to help everybody." Or in the ways of the archaic translation, "I am here for the good of the world, the weal of the world, W-E-A-L, the well-being of the world." That's Buddha's intention in coming, to be of benefit. So what is going to be of benefit? To know what is going to be of benefit, we have to consider what the problem might be. And what is it that what is the issue that we're trying to address? So in Buddha's life story, there are two moments that I want to mention that set a kind of framework for how we might consider what our process is, because the elements involved are still common today, as you will see. I think that I mentioned last time that when the Buddha was born, after he was born, he was taken to some seers, rishis, yogis, who were believed to have the quality to be able to predict what the young child would become. Wouldn't every parent like to know? In the different versions of the story, more or less agree on this, there were kind of two possible outcomes for the Buddha. Either one was going to be quite terrific. He was born the son of a king, the Shakya clan, probably a small clan in northwest India. He was born in just inside what is now the Nepali border in Lumbini Gardens. And so one said, "Well, your son," he said to the king, "your son is going to be a world monarch." This is a kind of classic title in the ancient world. Somebody who rules the world in a more or less worldly sense, but it all a chakravartin, somebody who is a good ruler of the world, but still at the top of the worldly hierarchy. And then he goes to another, the parents take him to another pundit, and this pundit says, let's see if I have it marked properly, in this version of the Tibetan translation that I've been using here, he says, "The rays of sun are very sharp, but the rays that shine from this one sun," S-O-N, good translation, right? He's making a nice little pun there. "The rays of sun in the sky, the rays of sun are very sharp, but the rays that shine from this one sun, your child, cool your body when they touch you. This is surely the light of a mighty one." So this predictor says, "To seek one sight of this mighty one, a chief, a leader in the world." But then they take him somewhere else. So that's the idea that he will become a worldly leader. Oh, Lord, the pundits are mistaken. These other seers don't really see. In strife-filled times, no monarch comes. This source of dharma and great virtue will conquer sleep and awaken. Poetic description of the process of enlightenment itself, awakening from sleep, awakening from the sleep of ignorance. So right in the prophecy there is identified the problem that Buddha seeks to address and that the Dharma has sought to address ever since. Dharma meaning actually from the Sanskrit root dhar means that which holds. And in particular, in the context of the Dharma as teaching, it means that which holds us back from disaster, from the disaster created by our own actions, the disaster created by our own ignorance, not knowing what to do, not knowing what not to do, or not knowing really how to behave, doing things that seem like they're in our best interest, but really turn out not to be. So in these two predictions, we see a kind of implicit dichotomy in the early Buddhist tradition, which then kind of gets resolved or addressed differently in the later Buddhist tradition, particularly in the later Buddhist tradition, I mean, after about 500 years after the Buddha's birth and after the Buddhism begins to go to China and Japan, Korea, and then even later than that, over the Himalayas to Tibet, which of course is where our main tradition is drawn from. The Tibetan tradition is profoundly based on the Indian tradition. Maybe you know that, but there was a very conscious decision in the 8th century in Tibet when Buddhism had already been in China for 800 years, and to regard India as the land of the noble ones, Bharat, India. And so, of course, there was influence from China, quite significant influence, particularly at the time that our tradition of Dzogchen begins to take shape in Tibet. But that's another story, maybe for the new year. So right now, I just want to say that these, in the early tradition, particularly, but I think throughout the tradition, and certainly in our lives, we see that there's a kind of contestation of what's going to happen. Is Buddha going to be a great worldly success? Or is Buddha going to be a great spiritual success? And talking to my friends and students, I think we feel the same tension, you know, between, well, I'd like to do some practice. I'd like to develop compassion. I'd like to sit. Oh, I'd like to do retreat. I'd even like to do 3-year retreat, some people say, but I'm so busy. I can't find 5 minutes and I can't find 10 minutes. We are pulled, are we not? Those of us who are attracted to spiritual life, we often have many demands on us, family, job, social demands. So how are we to adjudicate these? So I like to point out that the recognition of this tension is right there from the beginning. Now, Buddha's father, as it turns out, really wants him to be a worldly success. I find this with my rice students also. They like to take religion courses, but daddy wants them to be an engineer or a nuclear physicist or something, you know, really important, something. And so that's one set of tensions that Buddha ultimately seeks to find a middle way between, and that I think for us in the West as 21st century people, we too, who are spiritually open, aware, seeking to awaken, have had some awakening, we also find ourselves continually needing to negotiate the needs of the world, which are not negligible, they're not unimportant, with our own spiritual nurturing. So eventually Buddha marries, and he lives quite a luxurious life, which his father had organized so that he would never know that there was suffering. So he comes to about age 28, and he's really what we could call quite naive. And he asks his charioteer, Chandraka, to take him on a ride. He actually wants to go to a pleasure grove. He wants to take his harem and all of his friends to a pleasure grove. And in one of the versions of this story, It is said that this is the seeking that, or this is the desire that culminates in the end of all desire. So he wants to go out. He's been in the palace for years, and it's been fun. He's got everything he could need, but really, he wants to go out. And in that time, he encounters, famously, and maybe you know this, for the first time in his life, he sees somebody who's sick, somebody who's old, and finally a corpse. And what's this? Death? How can that be? And his charioteer, who of course is sent by the gods to help further the education of the Buddha, who by now has shown his excellence in scholarship as well as in gymnastics. There's a whole tale about his wedding. He has to show how he excels in martial arts in order to win this particular bride. And actually another mode of balance. So in his life, he's been a scholar, already a successful scholar, a successful, we could say, athlete. And now, when he reckons with death, which he finally, in the process of this moment, he kind of gets it. Oh, it's not just that that person died. I'm going to die. Big revelation. And of course, it is a big revelation when we come to grips with our mortality. And we know that it's quite difficult. And we put it off as long as possible. But then somebody gets sick, somebody dies, we get sick, we die, and it's a shock to the system. And it can really reorient our value systems. So meditation on impermanence has always been a very big part of the Buddhist tradition, to reckon that our time is fleeting, let us make best use of it. But it decides there's no time to go to a pleasure grove. He sits down in meditation. He has a great, greatly successful meditation. He meets a wandering yogi who looks very happy. And Buddha says, you know, in the throes of his recent revelation about mortality, he says, how can you look so peaceful when everybody's going to die? We feel this way, don't we? We read about terrible things happening around the world, climate change. Well, what's going to happen? How could we walk the world with a smile on our face? So the mendicant says, oh, that's because I've discovered something that's quite beyond life and death. Oh, really? What might that be? I must find this thing. So Buddha decides he's going to leave his home, which in Hindu culture at that time, as in our culture, you know, it's like not the thing to do. You're not meant to focus on spiritual things in traditional Indian culture until you've had a grandson. You know, you've done your householder duty. So Buddha spends 7 years or so in severe ascetic practices, starving himself. Sometimes you see images of the Buddha, he's just in skin and bones. This is from this period of his life, because that's what his Hindu teachers are doing. They're doing yoga in the jungle. They're standing on one leg for days. They're eating one grain of rice a day. Very severe ascetic practices. And finally, Buddha says, this isn't doing it. I'm not waking from the sleep of ignorance. And then he goes to Buddhagaya and sits under the Bodhi tree and awakens from the sleep of ignorance. He decides that severe asceticism is not suitable, but also the luxury of his past life was not suitable. Middle way. Buddhism, you often hear, if you read books on Buddhism, a middle way. A middle way between worldly lust for success and total renunciation and ignoring the cries of the world. That's compassion. Compassion is a spiritual quality that is central to all the great traditions, that is central to the Buddhist tradition, particularly is regarded as the very special, skillful means of the later tradition that develops in India and is the tree called the Mahayana, the great vehicle, which grows first from India to China, both by sea and along the Silk Route. Wonderful stories of Xuanzang coming to India in the 5th century, bringing back more wisdom to China. And then China, by the 6th or 7th century or so, China is really quite independent from India. It's developing its own forms of Buddhism. And Buddhism doesn't go to Tibet until really the 7th, 8th century, by which time there have been more developments in India that come into Tibet that did not go to China until actually the last 10, 15 years. Some of the great, like Shantideva, the great 8th century Indian poet, is now translated into Chinese. But back to my point. So the Mahayana, the great vehicle, sees compassion as absolutely central to its mission. Earlier Buddhism does too, but Mahayana now feels that the career of a bodhisattva, that means somebody who's committed to practice to benefit the whole world, like the Buddha was a bodhisattva. In the later Mahayana tradition, as it develops in India and later goes to China, Korea, Japan, Tibet, Mongolia, USA, there develops this powerful idea that if, in fact, you can transcend what is what dies, if you can transcend a sort of the ordinary sense of ourselves, there are many levels on which we can understand this. But I'm talking about the vision of the bodhisattva who says, for as long as space abides, so long may I be there so that I can resolve the suffering of the world. A paraphrase of Dalai Lama's famous phrase from Shantideva, the 8th century Indian poet. So once compassion and benefiting the world is central to your purpose, then you have to find a middle way between being engaged with the world and developing your own spiritual qualities. And this is the path also of the lay practitioner, us. We're lay practitioners. We're not living in a monastery. But we do deeply value qualities like compassion. So when we say compassion, that's kind of a big skyscape. And there are a cluster of qualities I just want to mention and then zero in on one of them for a few minutes. So compassion really starts with the middle way, a middle way of living and being in balance. Can also refer to this as the cultivation of equanimity. Can also refer to this balance, this equanimity, as the ability to see a profound sameness in oneself and everyone, looking through the differences of culture, language, skin color, religious tradition or not, gender. All of these things, there are ways, of course, in which we are different. We look different. We're different ages. We have different educations and jobs and all of those things, hair color, skin color, all of that. Yes, that's there. But that is nowhere near as significant for us who are developing balance, equanimity as a basis for our love, nowhere as near as significant as the recognition that all of us are profound in our heart of hearts. What is it that we want? What do you want in your heart of hearts? Something. Something. Whether if it's a spiritual state or a person or a job title or a family or what, something you want in your heart of hearts. And why do you want it? You feel it will make you happy. You feel it will make your life meaningful. And I am talking about the kind of happiness which comes from a sense of meaning, not talking about frat party night, which is one kind of, right? But deep and abiding happiness. Who does not want this? Now, people can be very distorted in what they consider happiness to be. We see that around the world. But if we're seeking to cultivate balance, an open heart. An open heart is balanced. An open heart isn't like, you know, open over here and then these people of this color and this tradition and, you know, holding these kinds of weapons and then the heart closes. From this country, we have an open heart. From this country, we don't have an open heart. That's not balance. That's not seeing the sameness, the profound sameness, even in people we don't like, even in people who are dangerous. So should we protect ourselves from people who are dangerous? Of course. Of course. But does that mean closing down the heart and forgetting that they too are human beings who, you know, have gone wildly astray perhaps, but still, why? Because they too think that this is going to be meaningful. Maybe it's, you know, insane people also want what they think will make them happy. But our point is that this kernel of directionality toward what will make us happy is something that we all share. And when we recognize it in ourselves, I want ice cream, I want chocolate. Sometimes I can't even resist eating way too much chocolate. Why? Because I like it. Feels good. Doesn't give my life profound meaning, but there's something very nice, you know, sweet, and then reading something. So we can, when we recognize how powerful our own wishes, even for a fleeting happiness, is, we can say, oh, I get it. That's what everybody wants. And, you know, it's almost like maybe, at least in my imagination, and maybe yours, it's like, you know, we're all multicolored kaleidoscopes walking around showing different designs to the world and different colors in every sense, physically, emotionally. But at the center, where does that kaleidoscope of color come from? I used to be fascinated by kaleidoscopes when I was little. It was a time when this is what you gave to children. And there would be this nothing, just this little bit of light, right? And then everything would come out of that. So that little bit of light is in the heart of every living being, we believe, from the earliest Buddhist traditions to the latest, we can say, very important already in the Theravada tradition, important in the later Indian tradition, in China, in Japan, certainly in Tibet, there is a light at the heart of everyone. And that light is unblemished. And that light is, you know, just recognizing that can help us have a little bit of balance. Even if people are going crazy, we don't have to go crazy because there is something that is actually the same in everyone. And if we can recognize this, first of all, recognize it in ourselves, this light in ourselves, then we can recognize that everyone has this. And so that our totally lopsided ideas, that's why we sing before every practice, may all beings have happiness, may all beings be free of suffering. May all beings be free of too much attachment and too much disdain. We have different words, but that's what we're saying. That's the cultivation of equanimity. Not to cling, that means not to be attached, and not to scorn, not to despise, not to leave others in the dust. So how do we do this great thing of cultivating this kind of balance? Of course, it's a deep process. We practice daily. We can. We study, we learn. All of the everything that we do at Dawn Mountain, whether it's Buddhist teachings as such, whether it's personal kind of processing, which we do like in our elements retreat, or more ritual practices, everything that we do is so that we can have this complete open-hearted balance. It's not easy. And the first thing we have to do is be balanced with respect to ourselves. And so on Sundays, we cultivate attention. Attention is the start of love. Attention is the beginning of balance. Attention means that you are developing the skill of just resting with your breath and accepting yourself as a breathing being. You're accepting yourself as a breathing being. What do I mean by that? One of the things that we do that we torture ourselves a lot, usually, especially when we sit in meditation, which is why people resist sitting in meditation, because we know it's going to happen. We won't be focused. Our minds will be all over the place. That sounds so bad. But then what sets in is judgment. I'll never be able to meditate. Everybody's doing better than me. I'm a terrible person. My mind is going crazy. I'm thinking of all these crazy things. Thank goodness nobody in the room, I hope, is clairvoyant. Know what's going on in my mind, right? Shame and guilt, Harvey talks about this a lot when we do, you know, real deep kind of personal inquiry. This comes up a lot and for us. So attention is a way of cultivating this kind of balance. So your mind is distracted. Just bring it back to your breath. That's all you have to do. You don't have to fight with yourself. You don't have to give a laundry list of all your, you know, every time your mind has been distracted. That's just another distraction, right? You just bring it back. So when I say attention is the start of love, it's the start of love to begin with for yourself. Stop criticizing yourself. Stop wishing that your experience was something different than it is. Is this easy? No. This is an ongoing practice. And don't judge yourself for judging either, right? So when we cultivate attention, we're cultivating just being present to your breath and accepting. You know, I wish I were breathing more deeply. Some people do, actually. Just accept how your breath is. Accept how you are. Because then you're getting out of the way of those very kinds of judgments are part of the clouds that cover your light, so to speak. What do you think's obscuring it? Not somebody else. It's our own, you know, judgmental mind. It's our own self-accusations, which if we don't take care of them, we will turn on other people and make it difficult to have love and compassion for them. Cultivation of attention is extremely profound. The Dhammapada, one of the classic Buddhist texts, opens with a phrase that says something like, mind goes before all things. The way your intention is, how your mind is as you begin any activity, is going to color everything about that activity. So when we cultivate attention, we're cultivating balance. We're cultivating balance between too much excitement, or we could say worldly extreme, and too much, you know, just falling to sleep, couch potato style. That would be an extreme of meditation, and not, of course, real meditation, but, you know, kind of solipsistic, just going in a cocoon. That's not what we're doing. Attention is exactly, precisely does what Buddha was seeking to model. We're aware of ourselves. We can turn attention to others and be aware of them, but we still are present to this light. We're present to our own being. And that's why sometimes we also practice being present at the center of our belly. In many traditions, the Chinese martial arts, the Dantian, or in Tibetan, the Do, it's a very, very centering place. So if we rest there, we can find balance in almost like a physiological level.
If you enjoyed this meditation, please visit our website, dawnmountain.org, to subscribe to this course and find other great Dharma offerings. May all beings always have happiness and its causes. May all beings always be free of pain and its causes.